This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
From time immemorial, beginning with indigenous councils and ancient wisdom traditions, through the work of Western visionaries such as Plato, Galileo, and quantum physicist David Bohm, mutually participatory dialogue has been seen as the key to evolving and transforming consciousness, evoking a flow of meaning, a Daya flow of logos, meaning, beyond what any one individual can bring through alone. So join us now, as together with you, the active deep listener, we evoke and engage in living dialogues. Welcome to Living Dialogues. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell, and with me for this particular dialogue, I'm really delighted to have once again as my guest, Matthew Fox. Matthew is the author of a brilliant book entitled One River, Many Wells, Exploring Deep Ecumenicism. He has also published a new edition of his original book entitled Original Blessing, as well as being the author of 20 additional books, some of them real classics in our spiritual literature here of the last quarter century of the millennium. Matthew is a visionary activist and one of the most important religious thinkers and teachers of our time. His theology of creation spirituality, the belief that we are born in original blessing, has reinvigorated the faith of countless seekers and earned him the headline-making censure of the Vatican, which officially silenced him in 1989 and then precipitated his dismissal by the Dominican Order in 1993 for refusing to be repatriated, as it were, to Chicago and to give up his University of Creation Spirituality in Oakland, California, where he now remains. He became an Episcopal priest, subsequent to being expelled by the Catholic Church in 1993. So, Matthew, it's a great pleasure to have you back here on the program.
Thank you, Duncan. It's good to be back.
The last time we spoke, we talked about your biography, your autobiography, entitled Confessions, which you wrote deliberately as a kind of bookend, as you put it, to the Confessions of St. Augustine, the 4th century Catholic prelate who invented the concept of original sin out of whole cloth as an administrative tool to more efficiently control and run the empire that essentially the church had inherited from Constantine. And now today you are using your own work as a kind of bookend by reclaiming what you believe is the original message of Jesus, the original message of Christianity, that we are born into an original blessing, a kind of basic goodness and not a basic defectiveness. And you contrast creation spirituality with the lamentable fall / redemption spirituality that has dominated so much of the institutional church's role in humanity for the last two millennia. So as we move now into the new millennia, I'd like to invite you to expand on those definitions and how you have literally reclaimed the original message, not only of Christ, but of the Buddha and the deep universal message of all faiths throughout the planet.
Well, it's a good summary there, Duncan, of what I've been about, trying to deconstruct, take apart the Christian tradition to find what's really valuable there and to reconstruct it in language and images and concepts that are practical and useful and effective in our time. And in many ways, this is a move from religion to spirituality. And in my latest book, One River, Many Wells, as you say, I'm trying to apply some of these principles across the board. So in this book, it's not a book of comparative religion at all. It's rather drawing on all the spiritual traditions, Hindu, Sufi, Christian, Jewish, the goddess tradition, Celtic, African, African-American, Native American, and indeed even today's science, which is seeking wisdom and sometimes even finding it, trying to draw on all these spiritual traditions so that as a species we can get moving. I mean, look what's happening in Palestine even now. We're still having these religious wars where my God is beating up your God, even though we claim to believe in the same God. It's a little peculiar. And obviously, my God is beating up your goddess for at least 5,000 years, and it's just getting ridiculous. The fact is the earth is fading at the hands of our species, and we better get our act together real fast. And to do that, I think we need spirituality, because spirituality takes us to our radical roots, and it takes us to what is potentially the best in us, our capacity for compassion, our capacity for celebration and joy, our capacity for forgiveness, our capacity for starting over. So I think a book like this is overdue, really. And of course, I'm not alone. The Dalai Lama is calling for more and more interfaith dialogue and experience. He also makes an interesting point. He says the biggest obstacle to interfaith happening is a bad relationship with our own faith. And so that takes me back to your original point. For Christians, are they still going to believe in original sin, which is Augustine's idea that was set up to run an empire with in the 4th century, or will they go back to the Jewish concepts of Jesus, which indeed is about original blessing? And so to really enter into deep ecumenism, you have to clean up your own religious act, your own relationship to your own faith, and you have to... In this regard, the historical Jesus movement in our day has been a big help. They're helping us see the difference between Jesus and Paul, for example. And
let's elaborate on that, Matthew. You make that point about the difference between the historical Jesus and the tradition of the cosmic Christ, and the difference between the teachings of Jesus and the teachings of Paul, both of which are explicated for our audience, by the way, in the Jesus Seminar, run by Robert Funk and others, and published in R Magazine, which comes out quarterly. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about your distinction that you're making there.
Yes, well, what these people have managed to accomplish has really been a 200-year search, but is essentially to boil down what are the real words in the Christian Bible that we can attribute authentically to the human person called Jesus. And they've concluded about 15 or 20% of the words attributed to him are really his. And that's fine, because that zeroing in on those then really gives us a picture of who this person was and what his agenda was. Now, it doesn't mean that the other 85 or 80% of the words are useless, or that people are trying to pull the wool over our eyes, but they came out of the community itself. So they were triggered, the wisdom that's there was triggered by the experience of the historical Jesus. And the cosmic Christ tradition is about the divine image of God being in every creature in the universe and in every one of us. So in that sense, Jesus is not the only Christ by any means. Buddha was a Christ, if you will, and Gandhi was a Christ, and King was a Christ, and we all are. And this is, again, where the 4th century church confused people. In its Nicene Council, for example, telling them that Jesus is the only Son of God, when in fact Jesus' teaching was that we're all sons and daughters of God, and here's how you do it. Mm-hmm. It's about compassion. Mm-hmm. So this is all part about cleaning up our own a tradition, so that we can appreciate and begin to connect to the wisdom in the other traditions of the world, because obviously the Holy Spirit and the Creator God is not restricted to one denomination.
And what would you say, Matthew, about the contribution of Paul? You're making the comment in the preface, actually, to the republication of your book, Original Blessing, that it is when the two traditions of the historical Jesus and the cosmic Christ are balanced that we have a balanced grasp of the Jesus story and the Christ story, and spirit can come alive again. And so what is Paul's role in this?
Yeah. Well, of course, Paul never met the historical Jesus. He came along after Jesus was killed. So he did have a conversion experience, obviously, and it was an experience, therefore, of the Christ. And the Christ is what the Buddhists would call the living Buddha, as distinct from the historical Buddha. The Christ is that spirit that carries on after the historical Jesus was killed. But there are issues in Paul, because he was a theologian. He wasn't Jesus, if you will, that that can confuse us. For example, he supported slavery. And he's invoked still today by some to in terms of homophobia, because he criticizes the homosexual movement in his day, although many scholars will say that was about the prostitution side. But nevertheless, he gets dragged into all kinds of fierce debates that take us off the essential message of Jesus. Paul brought together in himself the Jewish tradition, being Jew, the Roman tradition, because he was a Roman citizen, the Greek tradition, because he was educated in Greek, which was the reigning intellectual tradition of the time. And then, of course, the experience of Christ. And that's his power, that he brought the Christ message beyond the Jewish community into the greater community. But in doing so, he paid a price. For example, he has a split in his psyche about flesh. And my previous book is called Sins of the Spirit, Blessings of the Flesh. And I'm trying to redeem that word flesh, because beginning with Paul, who was Greek educated, you see, and it's the Greeks who had a problem with matter versus spirit, Paul relinquished his Jewish sense of holism and took on the dualism of Hellenism, of the Greeks. And so flesh became, he says, flesh and blood will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Well, Jesus never talked like that. And so since Paul, we've been dualistic, and it's got worse with Augustine and others. So he set us on a very wrong track regarding women and regarding matter and flesh, and that's because of his Greek education. Getting a Greek education that day was like going to Harvard or Stanford in our day. It gave you an inside track, but you paid a price for it. And the price Paul paid was he lost some of his Jewish wholeness, and Jesus thought as a Jew, not as a Greek.
And in fact, it's very interesting here. You talk about how in the modern era, one of your antagonists, or one who has reacted very badly to your publications, is the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith in the papal world of Catholicism. And unknown probably to most of our audience, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith is the old Holy Inquisition, which we're all familiar with from history, which was never disbanded and only renamed. And here you mention that the office of the Holy Inquisition and its new incorporated form as the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith remains essentially anti-Semitic and out of touch with Jewish theology and with the heart and mind of the historical Jesus.
Yes, far more committed to St. Augustine,
right,
than to the historical Jesus, sworn on with original sin. I think subconsciously, unconsciously, they believe that if original sin doesn't carry the day, that they're going to be out of work.
That's right.
And which may not be such a bad thing. But anyway, I think that is really the issue.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's very beautiful that you say that, because there is the famous passage or chapter in the Brothers Karamazov entitled The Grand Inquisitor, in which Jesus, in this imagined story told by Ivan to his brother Alyosha, comes back to earth in the 16th century and is spied by the 90-year-old Grand Inquisitor in the crowd, who knows who he is and immediately has him arrested and brought before him and says, look, we've spent 1,500 years, you know, establishing ourselves here and getting humanity to give us their freedom in the name of their freedom, because we've convinced them that they're basically defective with original sin and they need our mediation, and that they can't get there alone. So when you come back from 40 days in the desert and say, man does not live by bread alone, this is an elitist message. There's only a handful of people that can actually handle that existential truth. And we give them what they want. The bread we give them is miracles, mystery, and authority. And that gives them a sense of security. And we are the ones that are truly compassionate, because they are not capable of making this deep journey into what we would call the cosmic Christhood themselves.
Yeah. It's a question, coming at a question of trust, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And control versus control. Mm-hmm. And as you say, they are not capable. I mean, you see, and so we're projecting original sin onto others, really. And as you say, authority or control carries the day. And when you think about it, analyze that, That's really a fascist mentality. You see that only a few have the answers and everyone else needs to get in line.
And in fact, what's really deeply interesting to me, and this is a subtle point, but one I think is quite brilliant in your book, you identify or associate pessimism with this kind of hierarchical control and also with original sin, because there is this sense of down in the mouthness, as if something is wrong with us and we need to be redeemed after the fall. And it gives a kind of sense of darkness about the body, about oneself, about separation from the divine, as opposed to creation spirituality based on an original blessing, a basic goodness, that all of creation is good, that we are inherently whole, that we are inherently good. And what's very subtle here is that you point out that Jesus, as a Jew, was a peasant Jewish cynic, a member of a particular, a sub-tribe known as cynics. And I'd like you to comment on that, and here's where I'm going with this. Our modern secular media tends to decry and smear anyone who comes forward and challenges authority or the status quo as a cynic, as falling prey to cynicism about politics, as if we are the ones who are being pessimistic, rather than the dominant establishment itself, which thrives on propagating pessimism and a kind of false surface happiness
exactly.
to be achieved by materialistic consumerism.
Well, exactly. And in so many ways, the corporate ideology has picked up on the ideology of original sin. You see, it's really the same dynamic that you have with Augustine, that a few of us will run the world, thank you, and the rest of you are not up to it.
And you can go purchase your indulgences at the mall.
There you go. Exactly. Exactly. You can buy your way out of it, keep us in business, and that's your only way out. Exactly. It's really amazing. The parallels between the secular ideology and fall redemption religion, they've just carried over. For example, advertising, so much of it is based on the idea that you don't have what it takes inside. So you have to get it from the outside. That's external redemption, you see. So
mediated by
the powers, the power that wants to be and be and be. Now, as far as the word a cynic used of Jesus, though, that's a rather technical term. It comes from Dominic Crossan and the other scholars of the Jesus Seminar. In Jesus' day, there was this movement, and they called themselves cynic, but it didn't mean cynical. It meant they were they lived very simply. They went from village to village, teaching and preaching, really, about egalitarianism, justice, and simple living. And it's that movement that the historical Jesus was part of. But we can misunderstand it if we think that their message was cynicism. It wasn't. It was responsibility. It was about taking responsibility. And of course, that's part of the original blessing teaching too. If we all have the divine image in us and the spirit in us, then we've also got responsibility to apply that in our work worlds and in our all our relationships. And so you move into creativity then. What are we doing with this holy imagination, this divine image that is ours? And how are we returning blessing for blessing? Because as you say, if you begin by teaching people pessimism, they don't have the energy to do anything worthwhile.
Exactly.
And creativity itself, there are studies now that show that the sixth chakra, when you do creative work, meta-endorphins are released in your brain that in fact relieve stress and relieve pessimism and cynicism. So the very work of creativity is physiologically encourages our joy and our sense of community. So that's one reason why, for example, at our school, we emphasize what we call art as meditation, that doing meditation that is centered on the process of creativity itself is a healing work, and it empowers you to help others to heal. So there is, as you say, a big difference between starting with the pessimistic notion of original sin or starting with original blessing.
And here, I think, another wonderful trope, if you will, on what you've just said is that modern global corporatism as, in a sense, the last totalitarianism, you know, the modern version of what was once the Greco-Roman Empire that Constantine invited the church into to share power with him in 312, basically thrives on a control through disempowerment of the individual through this sense of passive consumerism, passive entertainment, what Ralph Nader has gone so far as to call the use of television as corporate child molesters that actually distract the child from his innate sense of well-being or her sense of creativity. And I think this is very profound what you're saying about it's only by sharing in the creative power that one feels the energy, or even one might say the kundalini in some form, come through one's body, so that you've got a sense of joy and a sense of energy to work in the world with compassion. And here I'd like you to speak, Matthew, about your beautiful notion of co-creation, that we are co-creators with the divine, that we are imminently and inherently divine and part of the whole awesome unfolding of the universe, and not simply passive or submissive, subjugated observers.
Exactly. And there's a whole conspiracy to render us couch potatoes.
In many ways.
In many ways. Yeah. And I associate this with the fifth chakra, too. You know, the fifth chakra is our throat, and it is meant to be our giving out of our wisdom to the world, but instead we've turned it into gluttony, and this new name is consumerism. We're taking in, and so the constant taking in of goodies and other people's images is a squelching, it's a gagging of our voice, a gagging of our throat. So instead of the throat being a birth canal for our wisdom, it's becoming a place for gorging ourselves. So we've really reinvented the capital sin of gluttony. Gluttony comes from the Latin word glutus, that means throat. We've reinvented it. It's not just about eating and drinking too much. It's about eating up the entire world, which is literally what we're being set up to do by an awful lot of our media's ideologies. So the antidote to this, as you say, is co-creation, the discovery that each one of our chakras is a birthplace for the Christ, if you will, or for Kundalini, or for the goddess, or whatever you want to call it. That, as Eckhart said, we are all meant to be mothers of God. And that really our species is uniquely gifted with the power of creativity. And it's clear that this power of creativity can be used for destruction and evil, or for blessing and good. Obviously, for example, creating ovens at Auschwitz to be efficient about murdering innocent people is a misuse of our creativity. And all human evil carries such power with it because the divine and the demonic are so close right along this line of creativity. And here's something very practical. You know, we have this so-called debate in our country about education today. I say so-called because I've never heard a politician say anything intelligent about it. They're all talking about giving more tests and exams. Mm-hmm. I'm in education. That's not the way you redeem education. The key is creativity. What's unique in the human intelligence is our creativity. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to renew education. We should be reinventing it entirely around creativity. And once you get the human person excited about the potential for giving birth, then everything else flows. It's not about taking exams. It's about releasing our powers of co-creation. And once you do that, you renew education, and you renew a culture, and you renew individuals, because hope comes when you create. And was it Otto Rank said that pessimism comes from a repression of creativity. So the pessimism that our media culture thrives on, which you're talking about, and that the advertising and consumer economic system requires. No wonder we have the educational system we do that doesn't even use the word creativity in its debate about how to renew education. And it's appalling.
Yes, and in which the word imagination is almost a swear word. It's verboten.
Exactly. You know, I was in New Hampshire 2 years ago, and a fundamentalist group had taken over the election of the school board. They had won the election of the school board in this town in New Hampshire. The first decree that this new school board put out was this: henceforth, in the public school system in this town, no teacher was allowed to use the word imagination in the classroom. Isn't that incredible?
Incredible.
And I asked, I said, what? Well, I don't get it. You know?
Yeah, right.
They said, because Satan is in the imagination.
Uh-huh.
Interesting. Of course, God's there, too. Everything's in the imagination. That's what's so wonderful about it. Uh-huh. But isn't that incredible? Yeah. We now have imagination police, and they call themselves educators. Mm-hmm. Whoa.
Well, that's incredibly powerful story, because I felt it to be metaphorical, that imagination really is a swear word and verboten, and now you've actually articulated, you know, the reality is getting even more so. What I'd like to do here now is call attention to how you are bringing creativity into not only the classroom, but into churches. And I remember a wonderful passage in your book, Confessions, your autobiography, where you talked about how you had created these techno-rave masses to bring in intergenerational participation, with young people being able to actually, in a sense, create the form surrounding the liturgy of the celebration of the Mass, bringing in also artists and people, musicians, who could participate in this co-created celebration of the great miracle of transformation of the human into the divine, and the imminence of that that comes in when the Spirit manifests in community, when we come together. And so I'd like you to maybe talk a little bit about that experience. And what really amused me and delighted me was reading in your book that some of the older, more staid and passive members of the community had complained that these, quote, people were being allowed into the church. And your bishop, who ordained you as an Episcopal priest, wrote a letter to the congregation saying, let them rave on for God's sake.
Right. Yes, these technocaustic masses have really become powerful. We were able to acquire an abandoned ballroom in downtown Oakland, very near our university, and we have them regularly. And it's interesting, people come from all over the world, including television crews from Rio de Janeiro, from Germany, Canada, and so forth, uninvited, but because they sense what I sense, that our species needs an awakening today, and ritual is the shortcut. Melodomi Somme, the African spiritual teacher, says there is no community without ritual. So if we're going to bring community alive, we've got to bring ritual alive. And so I'm borrowing from this generation who have invented raves, all-night dance celebrations, because I believe that the language they use, multimedia instead of talking, and dancing instead of sitting in a pew, is extremely powerful and very, very ancient. After all, this is the way indigenous people pray, not with books and words, but by dancing, because that what that does is it clicks in your first chakra, really all the chakras, especially the first chakra, the chakra that connects us to the earth. And that is precisely what Westerners need. We're so in our head that we can rationalize anything and bore everybody with it. Worship is meant to open the heart, not just words and books. So we're having a lot of fun with these masses, and they're very powerful. For example, this year, a woman came who's a youth drug counselor in San Francisco. She brought 15 of her 17 and 19-year-old clients with her, all of them having drug problems. And on the way back from the Mass, they said to her, this is the first time in our lives we've gotten high without drugs. And the whole thing is, our forms of worship are not getting people high. And therefore, we're set up for addictions, drug, alcohol, shopping, television, all of it. If we can render worship powerful again, that is the shortcut to waking up our species and getting the creativity flowing and the hope flowing. And just powerful things happen at our techno masses. For one thing, they're very ecumenical. It's a form that's so fluid that many artists show up and they contribute everything from the music to the sculptures and paintings and slides. But all kinds of traditions are represented. Not just Christians are there, but pagans and Buddhists and Muslims. And it's becoming a vessel where many people can feel at home. And, of course, the Jewish tradition. So Yeah, people can learn more about this mask by contacting us at our website.
And in fact, this is a good place to end our first dialogue, because we will continue with the subsequent dialogue to talk about Jesus as social revolutionary and activist, and the connection between compassion and justice that you speak about so wonderfully in your new book, One River, Many Wells. And the reason I wanted to mention that was to invite you in these last 4 or 5 minutes we have, Matthew, to talk about the final chapter of your book, One River, Many Wells, where you talk about spiritual warriorship and how we can combine, as Jefferson did, an inspiration from our own tradition, reaching out and connecting with others and bringing our inner work and our inner inspiration into our work in the world to redeem the materiality of our planet and our common home.
Yes, this archetype of warriorhood, spiritual warriorhood, has been very confused of late. We've lumped it together with being a soldier and told the Pentagon to handle it. And it's time now to take back a spiritual warriorhood from soldierhood. There's a man in our doctoral ministry program named Duncan, who's a Native American. He was in the Vietnam War. And he told us that when he came home from the war, his elders said to him, "You've been a soldier, now we're going to make you a warrior." And it took 4 years of training. And I said, "What was it like?" Well, he said, "First he taught me to play the flute," and he plays the Native flute beautifully now. But he said, when I mastered it, they had a recital, if you will, the whole tribe gathered, and I played that night. And afterwards, elders came up, each with a knife in their hand, and took a chunk out of the flute. So at the end of the night, I had no flute. So he said, the whole training was like that. It was about letting go and simplifying. And the spiritual warrior has to deal with the heart. You see, we give a young man a gun and call him a soldier and say, "Get the enemy," and the enemy is someone outside. That's very simplistic, but of course that's how you run a war. The warrior has to go inside and find the enemies inside, find the inherited isms, whether racism or sexism or homophobia, whatever it is that's haunting us as individuals or as communities. And you have to go inside and find the joy that's there. You know, the Celts have a wonderful saying. They say, "Never give a gun to a young man who has not first learned to dance."
Yes, Robert Bly mentions that frequently.
Very important. That explains a lot of the police riots that we have in our culture today. Mm-hmm. We give young men and call them policemen, you know, guns at the age of 21, and then they'll go to a rave where people are celebrating, and they think they have to break it up. They think it's a riot because they don't know what joy is, and they don't know what celebration is. They haven't learned to dance.
It's just intense energy, and they're excited and threatened by it at the same time, because
exactly,
they don't know how to hold the space for celebration, and it's a party that they weren't invited to,
exactly,
because they were not initiated.
Exactly. And that's all warriorhood. Now, another prime example of warrior in our time is Julia Butterfly, this wonderful young woman who climbed a tree. She thought for a week or two to defend it against loggers in Northern California, 2,500-year-old tree. She was up there 2 whole years. But what's interesting is a young man climbed up there with her, and he lasted 3 weeks. He was a soldier and not a warrior. He got angry and angrier at the loggers. She was able to recycle her anger and call down to the loggers and create relationship with them. "What's your name? Do you have a family? Why are you doing this?" etc. She lasted 2 years. He had to leave after 3 weeks. A perfect example of the difference between soldier and warrior. And she, her father was a preacher, and she had learned how to pray. She learned to deal with her heart stuff, not just by projecting her anger, but by recycling it into relationship. And that's compassion, and that's the future, and that's the work of the spiritual warrior. And we're not going to get this work done we're talking about without warriorhood. It's going to take strength.
And I want to thank you, Matthew Fox, for your entire life work, for your courage in taking on the great powers of institutional religion and opposition within our culture, to your bringing forth, as it says in the biography printed in one of your books, that you have devoted your career to unleashing the suppressed mystical and life-affirming traditions within Christianity and other faiths, and in fact, all the other traditions you talk about in your book, One River, Many Wells. And from the bottom of my heart and from the appreciation of my mind, I want to thank you, Matthew, for your life work and for being a most courageous spiritual warrior.
Thank you, Duncan. Thank you for your work, too.
It's been a real pleasure to spend this time with you. Matthew Fox, author of One River, Many Wells, Original Blessing, and many other wonderful books. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell, inviting you to be with us again on Living Dialogues.
And once you have entered your free subscription to the Living Dialogues podcast here on Personal Life Media, future Living Dialogues will automatically be downloaded to your computer on a weekly basis. If you'd like to obtain a CD, MP3, or full transcript of this dialogue, or additional dialogues I've done with the many other transformational thinkers listed on my website, livingdialogues.com, you can contact me through that website, livingdialogues.com. That's livingdialogues.com. Thanks again for your deep listening. All the best.
Find more great shows like this on PersonalLifeMedia.com.